Welcome to The Change Lab, a podcast for people who are all about personal development, leaning into their potential, and becoming their best self. Just, you know, starting next Monday. I'm your host, Dr. Sasha Hines, and oh, it's Monday. All right, welcome back, lab mates. Joining us in the Change Lab this week is one of the most prescient and important voices in mental health, Dr. Ellen Bora. A board-certified psychiatrist and author of The Anatomy of Anxiety, Ellen is disrupting the existing psychiatric medical model, reminding us with penetrating clarity that physical health is mental health. In a world that has become obsessed with symptom relief, she will not capitulate to the quick fix. Instead, she asked people to consider doing the unthinkable, to engage in the hard work of behavioral change. Needless to say, Ellen is an august member of my personal pantheon of all-time greats in the field of psychology and psychiatry, and I have no doubt that her message and body of work will only gain more recognition and importance in the decades to come. So without any delay, let's get to my conversation with the psychiatric sibyl of our time, Dr. Ellen Bora. Hi, I'm so excited that you're here. So Ellen and I met in Sun Valley at the Wellness Festival a couple of years ago, and this is the best thing ever that I get to, you know, cyber hang out with you.
It is the best thing ever. There was something really magical and auspicious about that weekend, and it continues to unfold.
Seriously, I want them to do another one. I think you were going to come last year, but they canceled it, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah.
Bummer.
Maybe this summer. Maybe next summer. I haven't heard anything about it. I haven't heard a thing. So we'll see. It was so much fun to connect with you, and summer in Sun Valley is the absolute best.
Yeah. It's heaven.
Yeah. So I'm so excited to have you here. Yay.
I'm so excited to be here. I'm excited for our conversation.
Me too. So for those of you who have not read Ellen's book, you must. Everyone needs to read this because, you know, as a psychiatrist, you have such a nuanced take on medication and mental health. And I think to some extent, a little bit of an unwelcome message for people. Welcome for some, unwelcome for others.
Yeah, it is an unwelcome message for the most part, but I'm totally comfortable continuing to be the unwelcome message. I think we're in a bit of a moment right now. I think of it as treat yourself culture, where, and I think we come by it really honestly. I want to put it in that context. We're hurting, we've been shamed, we've been blamed, we've been judged, we've been put through the ringer of diet culture and so on and so forth. So we're really looking for some gentleness and some sanity right now. And what feels on the surface most gentle and sane is someone saying, there's nothing wrong with you. And the extension of that, it kind of turns into do whatever you feel like. Mm-hmm. Like, stop worrying about all this nonsense, all these conflicting headlines. It's dizzying, it's shaming, it's hard to do. You've tried and failed. Like, stop with that madness and just do whatever you feel like is always the conclusion there. And I feel like the truth is more complicated. It's let's not shame, let's not blame, let's not judge, let's acknowledge that we've set people up to fail in so many ways. And yet, for us to genuinely make progress and feel better, there is some hard work to do. And I am here with that message that this message is only comforting in retrospect once you've made it to the other side. But mental health is so many different things. But one thing that it is that we have not yet been appreciating is that mental health is physical health. That mental health is a reflection of healthy brain function. Yeah. And a healthy brain requires certain things: vitamins, minerals, nutrients, not being inflamed, steady blood sugar, good sleep. And modern life happens to get in the way of all of these things. So many of us are walking around with pretty unhealthy brains. And as a result, we suffer and we struggle with our mental health. And so my message is really these things that we think of as heavy duty, lifelong diagnoses and a trait about us, a fixed trait, something like depression, something like anxiety. Sometimes it's simply a matter of making sure you're actually nourished, make sure you're actually rested, like with real effective, good quality sleep, mm-hmm. make sure you're not inflamed, and a few other physical ways that we can support ourselves. And once we get our physiology stable, we're no longer depressed or anxious. And it turns out these weren't heavy duty, lifelong destinies about us. This was our body out of balance. And so once you make it to the other side, you want to shoot from the rooftops like, oh, mental health is physical health. I got better. And it wasn't through 7 years of psychotherapy. It was actually through a sleep apnea treatment and being less inflamed. But it's very hard to hear that when you're still suffering, because it can feel so invalidating. And it feels like a long path, a long journey to being well, which it's actually not.
Right. I think that's true, right? So it's almost like an offense to someone who's in the moment. And I know this, I know how it feels personally when you're reading an article or reading a book that's suggesting that perhaps something that you're doing may contribute to not feeling amazing. And instead of being like, oh, fantastic, I'll just stop doing this thing, you're like, I hate you. I'm gonna throw this book across the room, right? I don't wanna hear this. And then we sort of get irritated, like, don't tell me it's my sleep. I don't want to know it's sleep or drinking or the fact that I'm not exercising, because making those behavioral changes is really effortful. It's going to be really effortful. And I don't want to hear that. I want a hack. I want something quick. I want you to tell me that I can purchase something and it's going to transform my life.
Purchase it and swallow it once per day and be done. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of what you hit upon there is that a lot of the reasons behavioral changes for mental health are hard is that there's a real intersection between what's getting in the way of good mental health and what is addictive. And I think that we're in a moment right now, and this I think has evolved over the last 40 years, is that companies have gotten so smart. Mm-hmm. And they have figured out that to be successful, you have to sell a product that addicts the human brain. And this goes beyond illicit drugs. This includes caffeine, it includes alcohol, tobacco, social media, pornography, sugar, processed foods, what I call flavor crystals that are part of what make processed foods so addictive and hit the bliss point and not create any satiety. And so to be successful right now, you have to actually exploit the reward circuitry of the human brain. And so many companies have figured out to do that. And here we are at their mercy. And so these things are getting in the way of our mental well-being. But when someone suggests like, hey, maybe not 6 cups of coffee a day, maybe not caffeine in the afternoon, maybe not quite so many days with alcohol, maybe not existing exclusively on processed foods. When you suggest this, what you get in response, I just think of as like, they try to make me go to rehab and I go, no, no, no. Like you really get someone who is in the clutches of their addiction, seeing the world through the lens of that addiction. So there's a Stockholm syndrome. We have come to love our prison guards. Yeah. We see the world as it's me and my addiction against the world. And this person's trying to pry this addiction out of my hands. And we growl at that hand that tries to take it away from us.
Right. You're trying to take my joy, my pleasure, my relaxation, my me time away from me. How dare you? And yet, I think there is that kind of knowing, an inner knowing. It may be quiet. And that's part of what kicks up the irritation, right? It's like, I don't really want to hear this because on some fundamental level, I kind of know you're right.
And the trouble here is that we so are in debt when we need joy and me time. Yep. Like this is also true.
Yep.
People are very honestly, they come by it honestly, they're very understandably saying, my one joy, like you're going to take away my coffee, you're going to take away my doom scrolling at night. Like it's the one thing I've got. I live in service of everyone around me all day. My job sucks my soul. My family takes all of my energy. I'm looking after an aging parent. I have so many people depending on me, so much pulling at me. And then this is my one source of joy and you're trying to take it away from me. So I understand that feeling, but I think it's so important to discern the difference between something that lifts us up, but then actually drops us lower than we began versus something that lifts us up and keeps us up. that's actually rejuvenating and restorative. And I think that's also part of why it is so hard to take away the things we're addicted to, is that what we're doing often by engaging with these substances is not even helping us feel good. We're actually just treating withdrawal. And so, I mean, this is at the heart of the opiate epidemic. Like, we are such a plague on humanity right now, is that we are going through a million withdrawals a day. And so it's physiologically impossible to feel okay when there's been some kind of carpet pulled out from underneath in your brain.
Oh, that's so interesting. Thinking of it that way.
Naturally, like, we're just always seeking out with wisdom. Like, I know that that glass of wine is what's going to help me feel okay right now. But the reason the glass of wine is what will help us feel okay is that we are in a subtle amount of alcohol withdrawal in that moment. And so we're on all these substances that create the need for themselves. And we are existing in constant, like, let me find that thing and administer it so that I can just be back to my baseline.
Yeah. This is, it's so interesting. Thinking of things this way has really helped me with my kids with TV or video game playing. And I'm not a stickler about no video games. I think there's a lot of benefits to kids playing, you know, a game online with friends. They're chatting and connecting and playing together. And I think that there's a lot of awesomeness about that. And it also is very dopaminergic. And so when my kids will log off from it, there's typically a period of time after where they're just in a bad mood. They're fussy. They're cranky about something. And they makes them more cranky when I tell them this. I'm like, your brain chemistry is recalibrating. You've just been in this dopaminergic activity and now it's over. And so you had all of this like biochemicals and you're just flooding through your body. And now you've taken it away because we had to stop. And so you're having the inevitable rebalance, which means it's going to feel crummy. It's going to feel really crummy. And the same thing happens when I have an amazing weekend and someone's visiting and I'm just having the most fun. And then what happens the day everybody leaves? I'm like, ooh, I feel forlorn. I feel just bereft. It's the same thing that's going on. I had a surge of all these feel-good biochemicals just rushing through my body and then it's gone. And so I'm going to recalibrate, but invariably the next day I wake up and I feel normal again. Oh, okay, I feel fine. So when I tell my kids, I'm like, you're in a cranky mood because your body's just recalibrating. This is part of the deal. Like, if you want to play video games, this is the cost. Then you're going to feel crappy afterwards, which is why you want to keep playing. And I struggle with this too, because I'm also human and I have human physiology and I have the same wiring that you do.
I think as adults, I mean, we also get that dysregulation after screen time, after anything really rewarding or dopaminergic. And I think it's really helpful to have even just a list that we remind ourselves of. These are activities I can also turn to that lift me up, but don't have a hangover. And we're all a little bit different. Like, where you are, a hike in nature feels good. And there's no drop down afterward. There's just, you remain lifted. Spending time in the sun, spending time near water is usually beneficial in that way. For me, things related to music and movement lift me up and keep me up. So dancing, exercise, which is admittedly hard to do, but I always, and this is part of the behavioral modification of it, with exercise, for me, the key is just to lower our standards. We get so all or nothing about it. And that's defeating. And if I put on one song and dance in my living room, or I take a single walk around the block after a meal, I know that what the medical literature tells us is this is actually, it punches above its weight class. These are very effective ways to support insulin sensitivity, better metabolic health, and they're minimal. And if I'm like, you know, if I was having as my goal a 45-minute workout with a personal trainer, I would never do anything. But if my goal is take a single walk around the block after dinner, it's doable.
Yeah.
And so I think we need these realistic, free, convenient, pleasurable forms of movement. But it's also one of these activities that feels good in the moment and leaves you feeling better off rather than dropping you down into a withdrawal.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure I didn't describe that because I am not a medical doctor. And so the internal workings of our physiology is for sure not my expertise. But I mean, I don't know if I described what's happening with that dopamine equalizing that's going on. But I found that such a helpful thing also to think about, what are the things in my life, as you just said, which are creating a really big high. And then of course I get a low afterwards. And then what are the things in my life where it just sort of, it's a little more mild, it's a milder high, and then there's no low. It feels, perhaps someone could say that's boring. It also could just be delightful.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think sometimes it's necessary to recalibrate. This happens with the palate as well. If we're eating nothing but processed foods, our palate is calibrated to that way that Doritos hits our bliss point and just like explodes your brain. And sometimes there is a required recalibration period where you realize, okay, even like opening up an orange and eating that is also amazing, but it's amazing in a way that doesn't hit you over the head in quite as unmistakable way. You have to tune into it a bit. And I think that with so many things, there's even a little, you have to muscle through some of the withdrawal in order to do that recalibration period. But it's important, I think, to see it for what it is.
Yeah.
If you're craving processed foods while you're trying to recalibrate your palate to being able to enjoy real food, let that sink in, what's happening there, that you are withdrawing from a drug and craving a drug.
So interesting. When you're working with patients, and this is, so someone comes in and you're recommending, prescribing perhaps, behavioral and lifestyle changes, how do you work with someone through that process? Because as we all know, I mean, this is the Change Lab. We are constantly talking about change and how it's difficult and how we overcome our resistance to change. How do you work on that with clients?
So I'm very influenced by Gretchen Rubin's work. And I think she has, it's called the tendencies, where somebody might be an upholder or an obliger, a questioner, a rebel. I think it's those four types, unless I'm missing one. And I'm really thinking about who am I working with? And we all contain multitudes, but I'm very careful to dole out behavioral suggestions very differently depending on who I'm working with. So if I'm with a questioner, I do well with questioners because I do feel like questioners, there's a place of operating from, you used this term before we started recording, like being the author of your own life. Mm-hmm. I feel like a questioner is really standing on their own two feet and saying, if you can convince me, then I'm down. And I love to geek out with patients and say, well, here's, you know, from a neuroscience perspective, here's what's happening under the hood of the body. Here's what's happening under the surface. And sometimes someone can get that information and be like, okay, I get it. And now I am compelled that it really does make a difference whether I look at screens before bed or have a drink of wine or not, or keep my blood sugar stable. To be convinced with science, I love that. And that usually is very motivating because if you're like, I didn't know before and now I do, and I don't want bad sleep or I don't want a low mood or I don't want an unnecessary panic attack, and they can start to be motivated by, now I understand that these behaviors are contributing to that and they can change it.
Yeah,
I really do not work well with obligers. Actually, I find that really tough to work with because there's all kinds of psychological games, and that's the opposite in a sense of that's somebody not authoring.
Tell me the psychological games that you see. So for those of you that may not know, this is from Gretchen Rubin. She's not a psychologist, but she's so brilliant. She's actually a lawyer and wrote this book. She wrote The Happiness Project, which was so clever. And then a book on behavioral change called The Four Tendencies. And so from her observations, she sort of categorized people in different ways. So there's an obliger who's someone who will, they will do things if there's an external expectation for them to do it, but they're not going to do it for themselves. And then a questioner, as she's saying, is someone who is questioning the information. And once they know better, they do better. That's typically a questioner who falls into that category. Then there is what the rebel, who's basically just giving the middle finger salute to anything anyone tells them to do. Right? So that's a challenging one to work with. And then what was the fourth one?
What's upholder.
An upholder.
Yeah.
And an upholder is someone who will just make a decision and do it.
They're the rare breed who can make a commitment to themselves and follow through. Where that can be a tricky combination with functional medicine psychiatry, like the way I approach mental health, is that I can be very Mr. Fix-It and say, hey, you want to improve your mental health? There are these 50 different things you can do to support your mental health. And I've learned over time, as I've gotten more seasoned in this work, if I give that kind of information to an upholder, they run themselves ragged and they go all the way into effectively orthorexia, like a sublimated eating disorder of trying to do things the right way too much and become obsessive, and doing things the right way starts to get in the way of social connection,
right?
Self-acceptance, ease in their lives, and it becomes counter-therapeutic.
That's super interesting. Yeah. That makes sense.
So a rebel is really hard also, because that is the person who gives the middle finger to everything. And I try to win them over with self-deprecating humor, like, oh, you're seeing one of those annoying doctors who's going to tell you to go gluten-free. Like, don't you just hate that? But no, seriously, you do have to. But I try to kind of get them to sort of... It needs to be their idea. If it's just me telling them what to do, everything will backfire. They'll run in the opposite direction. So it's sometimes I have to do a delicate dance with them. Obligers, I feel like there's a spin-off episode to be had between you and me about obligers, because you said something brilliant earlier that I hope you'll just repeat wholesale about sort of being the good girl versus becoming the author mm-hmm. of your own life. And
So it's interesting now because Gretchen Rubin was with Scott Barry Kaufman. They were talking on his podcast, and I really respect and really adore Scott Barry Kaufman as a researcher and just as a thinker and as just a human being in general. And he took her to task a little bit, which I was like, okay, fair enough. Because he was basically saying, what is this framework? This isn't based on research. This is based on her observations, which is really important to understand. But also what he was saying is, where does this fit in with the big five personality traits? So could we reduce this down to like whatever your big five tendencies are? So anyway, he took her to task on this. But what I would actually say is it being less about your five personality traits, like where you fall in the big five personality traits, but more about your developmental stage. Mm. So obligers would be someone who's at stage 3 adult development. So you're a socialized mindset. Your sense of self is externally based. So you don't have an internalized sense of self yet. You haven't developed it. So you see yourself in reference to everybody else. So how am I doing? You like want to take everyone's temperature. So as an obliger, if someone's like, meet me to go hiking, like you're not going to miss that appointment. You're not going to miss that because, you know, there's an external structure and there's sort of reputational management involved. Or if there's a deadline or there are like, that's why obligers. They're obliged to do it, right? Yeah. That's a clever name for that. But they won't do it. They won't stick to their own plan. If they have it on their schedule to go work out, they'll blow that off. But I see it as a developmental thing. It's like, okay, this is someone who has more of an externalized sense of self. Someone who's a questioner is probably already in a self-authored stage. They're now at stage 4. They have an internalized sense of self. They base their decisions on their own values. They have their own inner navigation system of like, these are the things that matter to me. I live in alignment with my values. I do this because it is who I am. And I have an internalized sense of self. So it's not about how other people see me. It's about the decisions I'm making for me. And so it's a whole different developmental stage. They don't have to like weed through or like slog through the emotional morass of, but how are other people going to feel about this? What's my identity? What does this seem like to other people? Will my partner be bummed that I'm now gluten-free because he likes to go out and have pasta? Or, you know what I mean? This is very emotional for them. And someone who's a questioner is like, I've already worked through all this. I actually am making these decisions from an entirely different developmental perspective. So it's easier for them.
I think that with obligers, you know, you used the term good girl earlier. And of course, growing up, there's so much positive reinforcement of that kind of behavior. So it can get really seductive to just always be like, okay, I'm doing what pleases the adults. I'm doing what pleases the authorities. And no, the world does not stop asking in adulthood. If you want to keep going on good girl obliger, that will continue to be positively reinforced externally.
Yep.
But it really gets you disconnected from your own needs, your sense of your own worth, who you are, your personhood. And I see a lot of patients right now where they're in that obliger way and they're doing a lot for good girl. And what actually ends up happening is there's a rebellion that happens in there. That's not a very self-authorship rebellion, but it's just like, they're so burned out and even resentful on doing everything that's being asked of them that when it's finally time to do something for themselves, they've got nothing left for that. And that's the one claim to their own sovereignty and autonomy that they find is, I'm not going to do that because I've got nothing left. So I do think that part of the path to effecting behavioral change, helpful behavioral change for an obliger, for the good girl, is to teach them boundaries and have them start to say no and start to recognize their needs, their worthiness of getting those needs met, and to really start to write and be the author of their own lives.
Right. Because when they're in that good girl mentality, your prescription of, hey, these changes need to be made, perhaps feels more onerous. It is another obligation, another thing they must do for someone else. And then, of course, that then breeds, they may do it initially, but then it breeds resentment going forward.
Yeah.
So that transition from the good girl to the wise woman who's actually making decisions for herself that benefit her, knowing that someone may disagree with her, knowing that someone may have an opinion about the choices that she's making and can honor that and see that and respect that, and also is going to continue to act in alignment with what works best for her.
Yes. As an obliger might initially do something because I, an external authority figure, tell them to do it, but it's not sustainable. And eventually, because they come to realize, I'm not checking in every 5 minutes. This, I'm not holding your hand through this. This is something you're doing for yourself over the long term. Right. When it becomes for themselves and not for me, it falls away.
With that patient, the minute they begin to realize, oh, I'm not actually being checked on, they are not externally holding me accountable to this, then they'll start to blow things off.
And some functional medicine practitioners solve for this with functional medicine, with bots, with whatever, you know, ongoing accountability. And there's a lot to be said for that, but it's not repairing that developmental issue. It's doing nothing to fix that, which I think is the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh my gosh, it really is. And I would say there is absolutely no behavioral change that will last unless it becomes internalized.
Yes.
The person must internalize it. We all have the capacity to do things that we must do. Everybody does. Some people are able to do that for longer than others, but we all know how to do that. We've been taught how to, okay, I've got to do this chore or task that I don't really feel like doing, but I know I need to do it. Yeah. But no lasting behavioral change can be motivated by that for the long haul. It's just not possible.
For good measure, I feel like, at least from my perspective, I'm curious to hear yours. Rebels, it's often coming from a place of childhood home chaos, lack of safety, lack of containment. There's something where it's like, the way I am keeping myself safe and claiming my power is in thwarting all authority because I've come to realize what I'm being told to do is BS.
Mm-hmm.
It's hypocritical. It's whatever the case may be there. Yeah. Emotionally immature.
I wonder to some extent, and I'm just thinking out loud, but I'm wondering if a rebel is actually more of the prototype of someone who's not even yet at the socialized mindset, like even a younger developmental stage, which we call self-sovereign, which would make sense.
The beauty of your framework is that like you go through these phases where you become self-sovereign. You're like, I know what I want, what I need. And then
exactly.
You become socialized. And you're like, okay, I understand how my actions affect the whole web, affect yep. everyone else. And then with time, we can reconcile these two and hold them both at once and they can exist in tension. So it's a moment-to-moment trade-off process.
Yep.
Where we navigate the world balancing these two. It reminds me of yoga philosophy, where I feel like you can spend decades just trying to master the idea of balancing ahimsa or non-harming with satya, truthfulness. And this is sophisticated by design because they often are in tension. There are trade-offs around every corner, but that's the goal ultimately is you know your needs and your worthiness of getting your needs met. You know what you want and your desires. And you are carrying all of that out, very much aware of how your actions impact others.
So beautifully said. Exactly what I was trying to say right there. Right. Like you've internalized these earlier stages, but it's so interesting how this interacts with how someone goes about their behavioral change. This is critical and understanding, because what someone struggles with at one stage is totally different than what someone struggles with at another stage. And I agree, when you're working with someone has, like, to use Gretchen Rubin's framework or phrase for this, an obliger, someone who has an externalized sense of self, man, you are competing with so many other voices in their life. And that makes it so challenging, because they're giving equal weight in some way to everything. So it's like, maybe they're sitting in your office and they're totally bought in and they're all about it and they're actually really sincere. But then they're in another environment, and because their sense of self is externalized, they're in another environment, all of a sudden that takes priority, that takes precedence, right? So it's also just such an exhausting way to live.
Yeah. And I find there is often almost like childlike need to just collapse at the end of it all. And so then nothing actually gets done. I am myself a questioner. And that's, I think, really informs how I have structured my understanding of mental health, because it's basically, I am convincing myself with data, with theory, a new way of making sense of mental health. And I think that, you know, for the questioners out there, it's a helpful framing. And it's basically this, it's that we've been taught that mental health is a genetic chemical imbalance. We're taught that it's because we have low serotonin, we look at it from the neck up. We're being told that our mental health is a destiny, that it's a fixed trait, it's something about us. And I have come to believe that that's not only myopic and not a comprehensive understanding of mental health, but it's our least hopeful narrative about mental health. And what is more true is that mental health is not a fixed trait much of the time. It's a collection of symptoms, and those symptoms are communicating something. And what symptoms like depression, like anxiety, are communicating is either some degree of physical imbalance or some psycho-spiritual unmet need. Mm-hmm. And we can do something about that. So when we shift our focus to physical imbalance, psycho-spiritual needs, then we can roll up our sleeves and say, okay, let's get physical body back into balance. Let's course correct and get our unmet needs met. Let's get things back into alignment. And then we've eliminated a lot of unnecessary suffering. And what people come to realize is that we were not destined to suffer, that there's a lot we can do, and we can feel empowered, we can feel hopeful, we can feel better.
Right, because ultimately you really are giving people a message of radical empowerment, which is there's so much that you, that we can do to move the needle, to feel better, that we don't have to wait or rely on some external thing, then in fact, there's so much that we can do. And it does take effort and it takes time and it takes commitment to it, but it's in your control, which is ultimately a very hopeful word.
It's radically empowering, which can also feel radically overwhelming. It can feel radically judgmental. And I think two sort of cultural trends that I see going on that help me understand that not everyone wants to be just handed a message of radical empowerment. One is that meme that went around for a while, I'm going to take my stupid walk for my stupid mental health.
Right.
And, you know, there's so much in that, but I think part of it is a resentment of the fact that I can do something physically for myself and feel better. It's like, I resent that that was even true. We resent that it's effortful, but we also resent that it's trivial, because to feel like all I had to do was pull my butt off this couch and take a 20-minute walk and I could be less depressed is insulting on some level, because depression is heavy duty. It's big. We see the world through this tinted lens. It feels like this obviously must be insurmountable, and that a 20-minute walk can make us feel less depressed feels a little bit, we feel foolish and we resent the whole enterprise. I think that's one issue.
Right. I think for people too, when they recognize like, oh my gosh, my anxiety that was so out of control really had to do with the fact that I was drinking. And when I cut drinking out of my life, my anxiety really became extremely manageable. And there's a sense of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I waited this long. It went through all of these other treatments and things like this. And in reality, I just needed to remove this one thing from my life. And it's fraught. It's complicated. No doubt about it. But as you said earlier, the world that we live in now has been constructed to make these simple things difficult, actually. And so I totally understand feeling a little bit of like shame and embarrassment of like, oh my God, it's just this is what I needed to add to my life. Like, oh my gosh, what was I resisting? But at the same time, it's like eating whole foods and less sugar also makes you feel in the long term so much better. But the world that we are living in is constructed in such a way that that's actually a challenging thing to do. And then you feel like the outlier and you feel like you're being difficult. And so you're not just going with the flow and being an easy person. If you have certain things that you don't want to eat or drink or whatever, because it's better for your mental health. So I just want to say to everyone, there should be no shame, because it truly, we really do live in a world where the simple things that make your life or your mental health feel just more at peace are challenging now. Like, they've been made hard to do. So it's like you actually have to put effort into doing the small things that would have just been a normal part of your life.
There's a woman named Holly Whitaker who wrote a book called Quit Like a Woman, which is a fantastic book kind of detailing how it's been marketed to us, how alcohol is synonymous with boss babe, female empowerment. It's a feminist choice. You know, there's a lot pushing this in addition to all of the fraught issues, all of the cultural trends, all of the questions and pushback you get, all of the ways that your choice to not drink might be unconsciously perceived as threatening to someone who is drinking. So they're going to push back and make it an uncomfortable choice, and so on and so forth. But this is one where, to the questioners listening, what really is a critical pearl for me around alcohol is that part of the reason we like it is that it raises our GABA levels in our brain. That's a neurotransmitter. It stands for gamma aminobutyric acid. And it's our primary inhibitory neurotransmitter of the central nervous system, i.e. it makes us feel calm, like we're okay. And it feels good to feel calm and okay.
Oh, yeah, it does feel good.
our brain actually does not care, particularly whether or not we feel good. It is tasked primarily with preserving our survival. So when it sees all of that GABA, it thinks to itself, if a leopard were to come around the corner, I could be too buzzed to care and I'd potentially be in danger. So we have this homeostatic drive. We have this drive to make sure we get back to that state of a healthy amount of vigilance. And in the case of alcohol, the way our brain does that is by converting all of that GABA to a different neurotransmitter called glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter. And I believe it's that conversion that accounts for why at 2 or 3 in the morning, we wake up, heart racing, thoughts racing. We proceed to toss and turn for the remainder of the night. And then the next day, we're just a little bit more fragile, a little more prone to anxiety, to catastrophizing, to panic. And it's really just this GABA fallout. It's been converted to glutamate. And it creates so much human suffering. And all because there's a massive industry and a massive lobby telling us, obviously, the normal and right thing to do is have a drink at every opportunity. And so I think it is such a beautiful and difficult, I will acknowledge how difficult that journey is, but to get to the other side of it and realize I didn't have to be quite so anxious. And it just takes these behavioral modifications.
Yeah, that was described so beautifully, by the way. Thank you for that. I don't know any of the science, so I deeply appreciate it. Rarely does a psychiatrist or a psychologist make these suggestions, and not just suggestions, but say, like, in the way that I'm willing to prescribe you an additional medication that is going to change your internal biochemistry, I am saying with the same seriousness, this needs to be removed from your life. But that's not the message that most psychiatrists or psychologists are willing to. And I'm recognizing here a psychologist doesn't prescribe meds, but they could, with some intensity, make that request, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Of one of their patients.
I'm not even going to take us down the rabbit hole of the fact that sometimes the psychiatric medications that we prescribe are one more thing that creates physiologic dependence. So, you know, and that's a nuanced conversation. Of course, they can be a bridge. They can be life-saving. I'm a psychiatrist. I prescribe meds. But I think that we do have to acknowledge that they can also be one more thing contributing to this pinball game of our physiology, where you might have interdose withdrawal in between doses of medication, where a stimulant might impact your ability to sleep well at night or to have healthy gut function because it's putting your body in a stress response. Or a benzodiazepine is much like alcohol in that it rushes the brain with so much GABA that the brain has to respond with some homeostatic drive. In the case of the benzos like Xanax and Klonopin, it actually does it by downregulating certain GABA receptors in the brain. So then you require the medication just to feel okay and at your baseline, not even good necessarily. It creates the need for itself. It puts you at a place of relative GABA withdrawal just by virtue of the fact that you then have less GABA receptors in the brain. So all of these medications that someone might say, well, I couldn't possibly ask my patient to get better sleep or stop drinking or eat nutritious food. It's too hard. I haven't been trained in it. So we just say, okay, what I'm trained to do is slap on a medication here. We're chasing the tail and we're never addressing something at the root in the first place.
Yeah. This is a conversation I think that I wish wasn't approached with such ire and antipathy. Like people just get so upset about these things. But I have a deep belief that most people, if they're when they're in those quiet moments and they're willing to be honest with themselves, they know what they're doing that isn't serving them on a fundamental level. They do. Like it doesn't really come as a surprise. It's perhaps the thing that they're like been trying to convince themselves isn't a big deal, right? Don't you find that most people like, we know, we have that inner knowing.
This is really what my second book is going to be about. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there are so many cultural forces. I mean, big cultural forces, patriarchy, a kind of valuing of data and objective rationality over intuition and sensing. Like we have big cultural forces making us doubt ourselves. And I think it's a feminist reclamation to start to trust ourselves again, that we do know. And we are out of the habit of thinking that we know. And so we give our power over constantly. We doubt ourselves. We struggle with self-acceptance. We struggle with self-love. We struggle with knowing what to do, whether it's career decisions, relationship choices, what to eat for dinner, how to handle our kids' illness. We really don't think that we have a compass. And I think we actually just have a very dusty compass, but it's in there and it works quite well.
Yep, exactly. So I have one final question, which is, since this is a change lab and we're talking about resistance to change and how we change, when in your life have you had that feeling of one foot on the gas wanting to change something, but one foot on the brake resisting that change and just feeling stuck? And what, you know, what did you do to overcome it?
Being stuck in that gridlock to me is always, first step is to acknowledge that that foot on the brake is serving some unconscious need. It's not entirely irrational. It's actually keeping us safe in some way. It's an old adaptation that's become maladaptive. It's something that's serving us. So I think usually you have to just bring light to why is there also a foot on the brake. There's usually a good reason that needs to be witnessed and acknowledged. For me in my life, I would say where this feels most resonant is I'm working on my second book right now. And the mental gridlock there is that I carry old stories around writing needs to be hard. I've been using terms like I'm wrestling with these topics. And I have a story I tell myself, which is that I'm not a good writer, that this doesn't come easily to me, and that this is overwhelming. And I'm really trying to just tell myself a different story, that this is coming easily, that it's flowing, that I'm not wrestling with these topics, like I'm really enjoying, relishing these topics. And that story is helping, but I catch myself a million times a day with one foot on each pedal.
Yes. Oh gosh. Whew, I needed to hear this today.
And so to me, the solution has just been to simply acknowledge that and notice it with compassion and patience and sweetness to be like, yeah. And of course, that old story is a strong habit, dies hard, but just to keep choosing the new story because it really does influence how you feel, how things flow. And it's a little bit of a magical worldview, but I think that when we are assigned a mission, when we have some artistic contribution to make, because our unique perspective, our unique skills are asked for in a given moment, it doesn't have to be hard. It can be easy, that in certain ways, what wants to be birthed through us is wind at our sails, and we can just allow that by not blocking it with old stories about wrestle.
Oh gosh, I love that. I'm choosing this new story. I'm going to continue to choose the story. That's so beautiful, because that's exactly what we have to do again and again and again and again.
Yeah, that's right.
I love it. Well, I will hold you accountable to this. I will hold you accountable because, man, I need this too. I needed to hear that today for sure. Your voice in this space to me is just, man, the louder the better, in my opinion.
This is how I feel about you, Sasha. You are like, your frameworks are completely brilliant and eye-opening. And this is what we need. We need to understand at the root what are the sources of our suffering. And so gratitude to you for doing what you do.
I mean, from good girl to wise woman, this is what we're... the good boy to the wise man, right? But this is the adult journey. This really is the adult journey. And I think that you're a real voice out there asking people to do the hard work of owning their decisions, thinking critically about what they're doing, instead of asking someone to just quickly fix it or make it go away. There's deeper work to be done. And it's not always pleasant, but it is certainly rewarding. Thank you so much. I love talking. I mean, to be continued. There are many threads that we could pick up here. To be continued, for sure.
And continued and continued.
For more dirt on today's topic, make sure to visit the episode show notes at drsashahines.com. Or if you have any specific questions, you can shoot me an email at hello@thechangelabpodcast.com or find me on Instagram at Dr. Sasha Hines. If you're enjoying The Change Lab, there are three things you can do about it. Subscribe and leave me a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Share the show with a friend or five. Or head over to drsashahines.com to check out the ways you can work with me and dive deeper into this work. And if you're feeling wild, maybe do all three. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.